From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Thousands of demonstrators converged on the tiny town of Jena, Louisiana today. Their cause? To protest what they consider a miscarriage of justice in what's now known as the case of the Jena Six. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from one Morehouse student who's bringing dozens of Atlanta students to Jena. But first, we've got an exclusive interview from Iraq. Last week, General David Petraeus recommended a withdrawal of at least 21,000 surge troops. President Bush quickly okayed the move. The White House has said repeatedly that the surge is working. And to drive the point home, the president highlighted a new pact between U.S. forces and Sunni leaders in Al-Anbar province. Al-Anbar is a region in western Iraq and a former Al-Qaeda stronghold. We wanted to learn more about this success story, so we turned to Marine Major General Walter E. Gaskin. He heads the 35,000-member Multinational Force West, which patrols Al-Anbar. Gaskin is also one of the highest-ranking African Americans in the U.S. military. He says that while several thousand of his troops will ship home as part of the drawdown, the peace they've created in Al-Anbar will continue.
Well, as you are probably aware, they came in as a part of the surge force with a particular mission, and we were able to accomplish that mission. It's a part of an ongoing mission to eventually turn that area over to the Iraqis. So they were replaced in part of the area that they covered by the Iraqi army. So it would be very good having them aboard and having them be able to do the work up there.
Let's turn to more of the local issues. There was the assassination of a key ally, Sunni Sheikh Sattar Abu Risha. So how important was the Sheikh to your efforts, and what does his death mean to trying to hold on to peace or create peace in the region?
I think as tragic as the death of Sheikh Sattar, that we have seen nothing that indicates that his movement and the awakening for the Sawa Allah Iraq will it fragment or be broken. What he did for us was he was a galvanizing force. He motivated the people of Anbar in particular and Iraqis in general to stand up against Al-Qaeda, reclaim their country that he characterized in an awakening. His brother, Sheikh Ahmed, who is a leader in his own right, will be able to step forward. I knew Sheikh Sattar. I was motivated, and I liked him. And I even though I, like others, I express sincere condolence for his death. He is truly a martyr, and I think his death will cause a number of those who were probably on the fence to wake up and see that Al-Qaeda means them no good, and that to the point that they will remove such a national hero from among them.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq has carried out some brutal attacks against the local Sunnis, but are you ever concerned that in your training of the local Sunnis, once you leave, they'll turn against their Shia neighbors and the country will descend into civil war, that you're training people who might then go and, as part of the inter-country violence, be trained to kill each other?
Well, you know, the sectarian violence that they talk about is not religious. It is political. Sattar's mother was Shia. There is a growing desire for them to get past the political divide and get on with the economic development. They are not fighting for me or the coalition forces. What they are fighting for is their own country. The idea that they're going to somehow return to the fighting among themselves is ludicrous. They have a purpose, and that purpose is to reclaim their country. They will make the same mistakes that any developing nation will, but rest assured that there is no fighting for their country. They're fighting for the ability to have a country, and without outside influence, as in Iran, or interference, as in foreign fighters.
But when the president came to Al-Anbar, to Iraq, there was some tussling over money. The local Sunnis were saying, oh, the Shias in Baghdad don't actually want to fund the projects that we're supposed to get rebuilt. And so how do you deal, if you're talking about this as a political and economic wrangle as opposed to a tribal or religious wrangle, even then it seems as if there's not always a spirit of cooperation?
Well, if you recall, 3 days after the president was here, we had the Anbar Forum 2, where the vice president came out to Anbar, and one of those things was to bring forth a promise from the Prime Minister Maliki that offered $70 million of supplemental. That was in addition to the budget of $107 million. What is often misunderstood is just that the government, the central government, and its ability to provide for the municipal and the provincial government is based on a relationship of developing budgets. This province, the cities within this province, never before had to develop a budget. They were basically under the Saddam days, were given money and told that's it. So now as they go through learning how to rebuild cities based on the destruction, development of the state-owned enterprises, that's interaction that happens in every country, and it definitely happens for a very struggling relationship, which is sometimes very, very new and dysfunctional in some cases. And when you throw in the political aspects of Shia actually running the government and Sunnis who are trying to get that relationship, political relationship, so that they can best serve the country, will be a tug of war. I mean, that's politics. I think they are making remarkable progress, but to state that they are not doing anything because of learning the type of government they're doing, I think is a understatement.
Let's turn directly to some of the experiences that you and your troops are having. When the president came, he said, Anbar is a huge province. It was once written off as lost. It is now one of the safest places in Iraq, but it still remains the second deadliest province for U.S. troops. So how do you reconcile that statement with what you and your Marines are living on the ground?
Well, first of all, you have to understand what Anbar represents to the Arab world and to Iraq. Anbar is approximately the size of the state of North Carolina. 90% of the population lives along the Euphrates River, which runs anywhere from about 1.3 to 1.4 mil. Anbar has been declared by Al-Qaeda in the city of Ramadi as the Islamic State. Anbar touches three nations, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, and it is the gateway into the land between the two rivers. Last year, when they were, meaning Al-Qaeda, was at the height of its destruction, murder, and intimidation in efforts to claim this area as the beginning of its Islamic State, it was. I mean, and there was a lot of fighting. We've been able to root Al-Qaeda out of the population centers. What that has done is separate, as you would want to in a classic counterinsurgency, separate the insurgents from the people. People didn't want that type of thing anymore. And so we've been able to use indigenous people joining the military, joining the police, and we've placed those police in the cities in the numbers that provide security for the people so that they can know what it's like to have a normal life. So that's why the president can say this is remarkable in that transformation occurred over the last 7 months. So, yes, it's peaceful out here, but I take nothing for granted. I know that Al-Qaeda would like to come back, and I know that Al-Qaeda has embarrassed because they read the news and hear the papers of how they have lost. But the people, that's the important thing.
You are one of the highest-ranking African-Americans in the whole military, certainly in the Marines. And among soldiers, there's been a hemorrhaging of African-American enlistment in the Army, numbers falling by 40% for enlistments and reenlistments. How are things going in the Marines, and what do you think the military needs to do to reach out to African-American soldiers, Marines, families?
Well, I think it's a two-way street as far as African-Americans joining the military. For the Marine Corps, we are still holding at approximately the same level as society. And that, to me, is problematic in that we must continue to offer and get young African Americans to understand that the military is opportunity. At one point, especially when I was a young man, fresh out of high school and college, the military offered opportunities beyond what we could receive in society. A lot joined the military where there was instant recognition, and it was a meritocracy for your merit, what you did, you earned, regardless of color, ethnic, or national origin. Somehow, over the years, as the opportunities have gotten better in society, there is a somewhat loss. And this is across all ethnic groups, but because of the number of minorities, African American in particular, it stands out.
Is it ever a help to you to have lived part of the African American experience? What I mean by that is you have gone to school in the South, become a high-ranking officer, dealing with a very diverse group of people. Has it helped you to have lived part of the African-American experience in a diverse context when you reach out to these people who may be of different ethnicities within Iraq, different sects of the Muslim experience?
Oh, absolutely. I think when we say that we learn cultural experiences in order to better understand the Iraqis, having been in a minority, haven't had a chance to realize that you are a leader of all, I think that experience has helped me well, and I fully understand it.
Well, General Gaskin, thank you so much for giving us so much time.
Good talking with you, and thank you. Hoorah.
Marine Major General Walter E. Gaskin commands Multinational Force West and spoke with us from Al Anbar Province in Iraq.